because I'm not gonna out people for not knowing anything about Bonhoeffer, but I'm assuming that some people have never heard of him before this week. So we're gonna kind of start at square one and talk a little bit about who he was, his German context, who he grew up with, and then what happened. And then we're gonna get a little bit into his early theology, which is this entire book, it's his dissertation. And then we're gonna have a little discussion. So for the recording, I'm James Thalman. I'm a Union Theological Seminary student. And we're gonna talk today about Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his context and his early theology. Bonhoeffer was born in 1906 in Breslau, which is now actually in Poland, so way Eastern Germany, and then grew up in Berlin. And he was he and his twin sister, Sabina, were the sixth and seventh children in that family. And so there are eight siblings. And they talk a little bit about the different generational gaps between the siblings, but he was born into an upper middle class, and upper class probably by today's standards, German family. His dad was a professor of medicine in Berlin. His older brother became, his dad, Karl Bonhoeffer, and these names are still very prevalent in Berlin. There's a Karl Bonhoeffer building at the medical school. And Paula, Karl's wife, ran the house and taught the kids. And they also had a few servants. And it was kind of just a combined effort of, they were homeschooled and actually then took the standardized tests all these kids did and skipped a few grades so that they could actually start school earlier. And so Bonhoeffer actually finished his dissertation at 23, and I'm 24, so that's kind of crazy.
Better hurry up.
Yeah, exactly. And so if I say anything too fast, if anything's not really clear, please let me know. So his oldest brother, Carl Friedrich, was actually a professor of physical chemistry, and they were really close. And there are a lot of interesting correspondence between he and Carl Friedrich. Carl Friedrich actually got involved in the Germans' equivalent of the Manhattan Project. So very smart, brilliant physicist, but actually got out of the Manhattan Project and fled because he didn't think it was the right project for him to be working on. So he's the first Bonhoeffer kid. Second Bonhoeffer kid is Walter in English. And both Carl Friedrich and Walter fought in World War II, actually, because they were born right before, and were just barely old enough to get enlisted. And Walter actually died in World War II. He suffered a shrapnel wound, actually got to dictate a letter to his family, and then died in the hospital bed 3 hours later. And it is said that Walter was the mom's favorite, and so it hit her really hard. And she basically mourned for a year. And then after that, Dietrich kind of became the favorite boy. And then after Walter's Klaus, and he became a lawyer, and then the sisters start with Ursula and Christine, and we don't hear a whole lot about either of them. I think it's probably because a lot of times those biographers are men, and we hear more about the masculine completions of the oldest brothers rather than what his older sisters did. And then his twin sister Sabina, who fled to Switzerland in the mid-30s before the war actually started, and then actually was widowed and moved to Boston, where she lived. And she actually didn't get involved in the Bonhoeffer studies because it was too hard for her until the late 70s. And then we actually got to know quite a little bit more about Bonhoeffer from his twin sister, Sabina. And then Susanna, who he was really close with, his younger sister. So, big family. You can imagine a lot of different kinds of conversations because Klaus was a lawyer, Carl Friedrich was a physicist, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a theologian. And as he was growing up, he knew he wanted to be a theologian at the age of 12. And his oldest brother was like, why a theologian? I'm going to the school to be a physicist, to do something better with your life. And he said, but there are some things with the church that I feel need to be changed, and so I'm going to reform it myself. And so he did. And they would also, they were a very close family. And they would, they all played instruments and they had their own, almost like their own little band. There are some pretty awesome pictures, and I can leave some of these books here, of their house in Berlin, which is absolutely massive. And they have all sorts of house parties, invite their neighbors over. And so it was just kind of how the German society went. You're really close to your neighbors, really close to your families. Lots of intellectual conversations as well as music playing, and then getting out on vacation. So, big family of the utmost importance to Bonhoeffer. And I'm just going to go through a little timeline to kind of put it in the context to see what else was going on in Bonhoeffer's life in relation to the war. And so he was born in 1906, before World War I starts. And that's 1906. 12 years later, in 1918, his brother is killed in World War I. And then 15 years later, he completes his doctorate. In Germany, you have to actually still, and to still this day, complete a doctorate, your dissertation, and then a postdoctoral dissertation. So Sanctorum Communio is his first one, and then Act and Being is actually his second postdoctoral book, and it's about 3 times bigger than that. In February 28th to February 1929, he actually spent a year in Barcelona, and loved the summer there. And he was kind of an assistant pastor, and he was so loved by the congregation that they would post his name when he was preaching, and the congregation would triple in size, and they'd be the lead pastor the next week, and nobody would come. And so they'd stop posting his name to figure out who was preaching at the time. So loved by the congregation, and then wrote a lot of essays and early lectures at that time. The next year, in September 1930 to June 31, is his year at Union Theological Seminary, where he was a teaching fellow, took a few classes, and then wrote and corresponded a lot with people. And then actually worked kind of as a youth minister at Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, which I've been to, is not that far. It's about a mile away from Union, definitely like a 20-minute walk. And it is a different church, unlike anything that I've seen. It's a Baptist church, which was, it's a lot louder and more raucous than an ELC church in Fargo, North Dakota. So I can relate to that kind of awakening of a different kind of experience. And then one of the things we're going to talk about today, he returns to Germany, and then in 1933 he has this radio lecture called The Younger Generation's Altered View of the Concept of the Fuhrer. And so that's a little bit of what we're going to talk about with the different generations and being situated in between World War I and World War II, because his older brother, Carl Friedrich, fought in World War II and was completely changed by it, but teacher couldn't quite relate to World War I. Couldn't quite relate to that kind of experience. We'll talk a little about that. A couple years later, in 1933, and as an aside, Bonhoeffer is also very largely known in ecumenical circles, so he's known for his church work, for going to London, especially London, Denmark, Sweden, and Switzerland. And there, if you look at this chronology, a lot of it is that. And there's a book called Bonhoeffer's Ecumenical Quest by Cleve Clements that is about this thick and talks about all of his ecumenical work. And so in 1933, he separates from the German National Church. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with it, the German church is still a state church. And so it's funded by the state. And so to some degree, the state actually gets to say what the church says in the pulpit. And they kind of have the conferences and they talk about what they're actually going to say. Unlike in America where it's all, I mean, there is some kind of correlation, but there's supposedly a separation of church and state here. In Germany, there's not. And so German, he wanted to actually, he formed in 1933 the Pastors Emergency League, which was basically a league to say, a group that said, we don't like what the National Church is saying or doing, we have to kind of separate, which is kind of unheard of at that time, because the National Church is good enough for everybody. Um, I thought this is just kind of a random cool fact. He was invited by Gandhi in 1934, and it was going to be funded by his grandma, but he ended up not going because 4 days later, under Bonhoeffer's leadership, they actually did secede from the National Church. And so he was like, I'm going to go to India, but I actually have to stay here and work with the church. And so his twin sister Sabina left in 1938, so just a few years before the war really broke out, and went to Switzerland. And that's actually where, in her house in Göttingen, is where Bonhoeffer wrote Life Together. So if you can imagine, the war's about to start, Hitler's kind of coming into power. Sabina, his twin sister, like great friend, sister, leaves to go to Switzerland, and he writes Life Together. So I'm sure that some of you read Life Together. Actually, I'm not, because I've been busy with other books. But that's the context he writes it in. So keep that in mind if you're going to take a look at it. And then the next year, after writing Life Together, he leaves for the US. And Union actually brought him back to teach, kind of his full time as a tenured professor. And he decided to leave after 3 months because he knew what was going on after all of his ecumenical work, that he felt like he couldn't be across the pond watching what was going to happen in Germany, and then after the war, go back and help rebuild. He felt like he couldn't do that. He had to be in Germany where it was all happening if he was actually going to help rebuild the church rightly after the war. So he didn't actually think that he was going to get killed in the war. He thought he was just going to, because he wasn't a Jew, he wasn't going to get involved in the counterplot. He was just going to help keep the path, as he kind of talks about discipleship. So that's June 1939, and then in August, that's when the war starts. It's interesting that this is actually kind of a short chronology. He does quite a bit in between 39 and 43 when he gets arrested. Including meetings in London and Denmark, and telling the ecumenical people who involved in those what the German situation actually is. Because the National Church was saying, like, everything's great, obviously we're doing well, you can see that we're doing well, everything's great. And he was saying, like, obviously nothing's, it's a different kind of narrative, that's propaganda. So he was having some really big meetings with, especially a pastor named Bishop, well, a Bishop Bell, who was good friends with Winston Churchill. And as they were getting more involved into the counterplot, he was in conversations with, Bonhoeffer was not in direct conversation with Winston Churchill, but Bishop Bell was. And they were trying to work together to make sure that the, as soon as the regime was flipped over, that it was gonna be properly instituted instead of going back to a monarch like they wanted to before World War I. And amidst all of that, in January of 1943, he gets engaged. And then in April, he gets sent to prison in Tegel, which is in just the middle of Berlin. He spends a year and a half there and writes, he gave it to Peggy and Chuck, but Letters and Papers from Prison is a book about this thick. And he smuggles them out through the guards because his uncle is a major in the German army, and he's kind of like treated like royalty, like, oh man, we have a Bonhoeffer in prison. It's kind of like a big deal. And so he's treated really well. And so he writes all these letters and papers. He writes lectures and starts a manuscript for a new book, and then also does regular ecumenical correspondence, and is also a pastor to many of the inmates. He was a busy dude in prison. I don't think this guy slept very much. And he gets transferred a few times. The 20th of July, 1944, is when the Stauffenberg plot to assassinate Hitler failed. And this whole time while he's in Tegel, they don't know, the German, the SS, and the Gestapo don't know that he's been involved in this counterplot. And we'll talk a little bit about that. They think he got arrested for his work, his ecumenical work, because he was rocking the boat a little bit too much. And so the Stauffenberg plot fails. And then they find all of these files incriminating Bonhoeffer. A couple months later. And that's when he knew that he was going to die. And so he spent a year in Tegel doing all this stuff, kind of just saying, like, you know, whatever, I'll sit in this prison and then I'll be free eventually and I'll help rebuild the German church. Because they don't know. They don't. All of these files are secretly stacked and nothing's going to incriminate me. They found out, the plot failed, and then his writing completely changes. And in April of 1945, he's transferred to Flossenbürg, which is a concentration camp, and executed by the state at 33. So, any history buffs in here want to add to those the context?
I just have two questions.
Yeah, go for it.
So when you're talking about the church of the state, mm-hmm. is that supporting Hitler and what's going on?
Absolutely.
Okay, so yeah. He is saying, he's having conversations about what's actually happening with...
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the state church and the state are coming together and saying, like,
right.
And sending the same message of German excellence.
Okay.
And saying that everything's fine.
It was a German Christian.
Yep.
Not the whole Christian in Germany.
Okay. Just, yeah, German.
Yeah, certainly. No, there are many different. It's not.
Yes.
It's not all the German Christians saying.
German Christian is one of very. Yes, they supported him, Hitler.
Okay.
But not every group supported Hitler.
Right.
Certainly.
Yeah. So, but he was trying to shed light on what was actually happening.
Yep.
Okay.
That church started in the 1800s and it was an amalgam of the state church. In fact, that's why a lot of Germans came to America, because they didn't want to give up their Reform or they didn't want to give up their Lutheran, because this was a blending.
Okay.
So it was very much institutional, political institution in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then he gets arrested because he's doing that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But he's secretly connected to this other thing.
Yeah, and so one of the things that kind of came over was he was obviously pegged by the people who were in charge of the German state church, and they were kind of wary of his ecumenical work. And so as soon as World War II started, they wanted to draft him as soon as possible and put him on the front lines. They have to deal with him. And so he applied for military chaplaincy so he could work somewhere else. They, of course, denied that. And then, because his uncle had this great position, they kind of maneuvered and put him into like some back office. And so he was working in the army because everybody had been drafted. And so he was saying, like, I'm working for you guys. But really, he was working with counterintelligence.
Gotcha.
Yep. And so nobody knew what he was working with counterintelligence because he was just had this facade of working with the German army.
I read an article once where I thought it was very interesting how so-called Christians of the German Christian Church, if you can call it that, what we call the Lutheran Church, mm-hmm. behaved. Because part of it was, oh yeah, you know, we're in bed with the state and everybody's happy and I'm getting mine. Then you had a branch of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Germany, which was, well, we know this is not right, but we'll just lay low and hope it'll blow over. And then you had Bonhoeffer's community and others like it who are working to really act against the state because they realized it was so demonic.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting, you know, because how people react to situations. I'm going to get something out of this. Keep your head down. Maybe something bad won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to change this or work against it.
It is one of the... the narratives that we talked about in my class in the fall was Vicki Barnett has written a few books, and she has a forthcoming book about the fact that many people did actually know what was going on. The narrative you hear is kind of like, we didn't know it was this bad. How could it was just so dehumanizing? How could anything actually this bad happen? But there are people who have been outside the concentration camps, and you can they would tell you not to go out that night because they were going to burn bodies or dump ash. And so people knew, and word spread. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
And what interests me today is the so-called Christian response to the environmental crisis.
Mm.
It's no problem. Well, we know something's not right, but, you know, maybe it'll blow over. then you've got your Christian-linked environmentalist who are saying we need to be a major repentance. To me, that's what it's interesting. Mm-hmm.
You said that his writing changed once he knew he was going to be executed?
Yeah.
How did it change?
He was always kind of, throughout his life, he was very solemn, but he was never kind of like stern and unhappy. And after that, so he wrote Discipleship, which is, he talks about single-mindedness, which is kind of just like following Christ. Just like trying to, like, your hardest just to follow Christ. And it's kind of, it's simplistic because it's also a book that thing. But after that, he starts questioning, like, because he thought he was doing the right thing. And he writes a poem. He just spends a lot of time thinking about what it means to be a Christian. And he talks a little bit about religionless Christianity, which is something that, because he was killed before he could fully form what that meant, is kind of this big amorphous theory of like what it means to be a Christian in the secular world. He had plenty of secular friends who were doing great things, and he was just kind of confused about different influences and moral coding. Mm. Yeah.
I think part of it, as I recall, pondering, going along living your life and doing what you can do and enjoy doing and like to do, and all of a sudden the title in the translation, I don't know what it sounds like, the cost of discipleship,
yeah,
comes across in German, but that, hey, this is serious stuff. This is where all the, you know, I think it was a very sobering time for him to say, yeah, you either are a faith or you're not, and if you are a faith, it should be more life-changing, and I think that's where a lot of his popularity in more recent, more modern times comes from, is people saying, well, this is, which is really interesting today, because as you look at secularization talk all over the place, he's a pretty straight head in that image of him, yeah, from my reading. So it's like, oh, this is gonna kill me. Better think about what I've been doing. Maybe that's too simplistic.
Well, a quick note about the cost of discipleship. We have a couple Bonhoeffer books in the library, but as soon as Bonhoeffer died, they let it sit for a little bit, and then Macmillan got a hold of it, it's a press in London, and pushed out all of his stuff as soon as he could. And so they're much shorter books, they're stylized, and all the Bonhoeffer scholars who wrote and translated the Dietrich Bonhoeffer works, all of these blue books that you see, hate them, because they're not word for word. They're just kind of like, it's more of an interpretation than translation. So there's this is the volume 1 of 17 Dietrich Bonhoeffer works. It's extensive. And they actually recently got done, like 2013 was when the last one came out. And so they met with some of his best friends. Eberhard Beke was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's best friend. They met with Sabina, and they talked with her about what do you think he meant by this, and his handwriting. I don't know if anyone has seen. I've shown a few people his handwriting. It's chicken scratch. It's horrible. And I read German, and there's just no way that I can read that. So they talked with people who could actually read his handwriting, and took about 60 years to actually get something that they thought was pretty close to what he meant.
Wow.
Yeah. So. Where I'm always taught to take those, the cost of discipleship, life together, creation and fall, all of these ones that don't look like this, with a grain of salt, because they're interpretations instead of translations.
Did he write it all about the connection to dying at 33?
I think. Because he didn't think he was going to die for the first year or so in Tegel, he didn't really internalize it until the very end. And his last letter was in February, and he was killed in April. So I think that if we had those kinds of letters, we probably would see a little bit more of him wrestling with that. But he didn't have anything. And that's another unfortunate thing about doing Bonhoeffer studies is that a lot of the stuff was lost, or like his stuff that when he was writing for at Union, he would like write hand in, because they didn't have computers where they could print off multiple copies. It was like one typewritten copy that you hand to the professor. You have to actually have, like, ask for it back and get it back. And so we asked professors, like, hey, did you have this paper? And they were like, no, actually, I threw it away. And we're like, so there's some things that we know are just lost. And he writes about it.
I can't remember, right? I think I heard 33, too, but if he was born in 06, he would have been actually closer to 40 when he died, in 45. Mm-hmm.
39, yeah.
But that's not a correcting. It's just you were thinking about the youthful time of his death. I'm not sure if 39 is a whole lot older than 33.
But Jesus died at 33.
Well, okay, all right. That was what I was picking up in your question, and that's why I mentioned it. So he was maybe a little older.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
If he was questioning what it meant to be a Christian at the end of his life, ironically, he's doing the exact same thing that Jesus did, and the exact same fate is upon him.
So I think one of the things to kind of further solidify his context, and there's a copy out in the library if you want to read the entire thing. He did a radio address in 1933, which was a couple years after he wrote his dissertation, but it's a pretty good framing of his context as Bonhoeffer sees it. And so he's kind of framing his own context for us. And so I'm just going to read a little bit of it. And it's I'm not going to read a whole lot, but if you want to like close your eyes and pretend I'm Bonhoeffer on the radio.
Just translate it.
Don't read in German. Don't read in German. All right. It is really interesting to hear how the different generations between World War I and World War II influenced how Bonhoeffer viewed himself within that context. So it's not the whole thing, it's about 10 pages. If you want to read it, I'm just going to read a few snippets. So three brothers, of whom the eldest was born in 1900, the second in 1905, and the third in 1910, were therefore 33, 28 and 23 years old, embody the difference today between three generations. So Bonhoeffer was born in 1906, so he's stuck in the middle. The greatest difficulties in the current debate with and within the younger generations have their roots in the same disunity. The first, people who have experienced death, who have, so to speak, stepped daily out of death into life, who have come to know life as action and profit, and who thus have a very special range in their thinking and desires. There is an invisible, impenetrable barrier between those who fought in the war and those who are only a little younger, who reached maturity during the period of collapse. It was under pressure from this generation of war veterans, the World War II veterans, the World War I veterans, that the younger generation grew up. They have two main characteristics. On one hand, they have been given the knowledge that their older brothers acquired firsthand, and thus they have been made aware of life in its entirety, with all its uncertainty and dubiousness. On the other hand, this probably differs from the question facing the older ones, in that the latter experienced it themselves in the middle of a situation of responsibility, that is, one they continually had to overcome in their lives. And then he continues on a little bit more, and talking about overarching monolithic statements made about the younger generation, he says, nonetheless, a few generalizations may be made about the younger generation as a whole. And that's all three of these groups, those who fought in the war, those who grew up in the war, and those who did not grow up in the war, all within a span of 10 years. They reached maturity during a period of history during which the previously well-established Western world came apart at the seams. War, post-war period, crisis. Thus, the inner task facing them could only consist of the attempt to avoid being pulled into complete collapse and instead to find the foothold that would allow them a continued existence. Three impressions shaped their move toward this foothold. First, in the collapse, they experienced the triumph of objects over humans, of machines over their creators. Technology, which was intended to master nature, had been turned against defenseless humans and thus robbed of its essential meaning. Second, the impetus of the entire existing political, intellectual, and religious ideology seem to have been proven. And third, the millions who fell in the Great War, the revolutionizing masses of a post-war period, and the million-strong army of unemployed during the crisis must have given the younger generation a convincing impression of the meaninglessness and complete isolation of the individual and the blunt power of the masses. A sense of the individual and the sense of true community seem to have been completely destroyed.
It's interesting, I was thinking about folks. And all that generation that was born right after World War I came of age in the Depression, and be the point in World War II, then they come back, and there's a similarity perhaps between all of them as they take on recreating America in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And then you see in some ways their children who all of a sudden say, well, wait a minute, we want to do our own thing, all of the 60s and the 70s. So you see how those sweeps do impact some of how people see things and interact with things. And not everybody, but there's those strong themes that go through, and the three divisions you use reflect three different reactions to what was going on in Germany.
And
between the wars.
I think that there have been some writings about this, as comparisons to now, where I was born into and came of age after 2009 and the great recession, into a time where education is too expensive to achieve, where debt spending, and so capitalism is not working for my generation, and my parents can't relate to that because they're old enough to have seen it.
They felt they benefited from it.
Yeah.
And you're saying, wait a minute, are we?
Yeah. Yeah. And so even me personally, are we? And or am I? And instead of just asking the question of like who benefits generally from capitalism, where it's framed in at least for me that it's not really working for anybody right now.
1%.
Yeah.
For a while.
You know, since we have someone from Germany here in Altwood, and she speaks English pretty well, I'd be really curious to hear any response she might have to what you said, or what the presence of Bonhoeffer might have in the culture today, or the state of the church, because I do not think that the state church is quite as clearly present as it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, she pays a church tax, but if she doesn't go to church, she doesn't pay the tax. Is that correct?
No.
So,
she can opt out of the church tax.
Yeah,
but you pay it unless you opt out of it.
And most people do not pay it because there is only. I mean, I'm not going to speak for her, but it might be interesting to hear from her.
You don't have to. Or if you want
to. I have a question. I pay. I'm in the church and I pay tax to the government, but the government, they pay the money for the church, to the church. Yes. But not all people are Christians and they are not in the church. You have to be a member in church, what you have. You can be a member in the church, but then you have to you have to get the information to the government. I'm a Christian, a Protestant, or a Catholic, and then you have to pay the tax.
But most people aren't even being baptized today, is that correct in Germany?
No, that's not true.
We don't have, not many Christians.
I was an exchange student in high school in Northern Germany, and all of my friends were baptized and confirmed, even if we in America would call them secular.
In those Germany, maybe. Well,
Hamburg.
Hamburg, yes. West Germany. I grew up in East Germany.
Okay.
I'm from the East Germany. But in West Germany now more and more too. It's more secular.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of Bonhoeffer's impact in Germany today, a lot of my friends in Germany will say, Bonhoeffer who? like, do you mean Carl? Because he was involved in physical chemistry.
Yeah. But it's a famous person for Germany and for Christian and for not Christian too. Many, many people know him.
Yeah.
And the history and the...
By and large, too, he became famous in America much after the war. If you ask people about the Confessing Church, which is his church that he started, in contrast to the National Church, a lot of people didn't know Bonhoeffer during the war. He kind of became famous post-mortem.
Well, like you kind of said, his tomes and his big books, those 19 volumes of theology, and how it made him popularized.
Yeah,
it was the smaller ones and the opposition to Hitler and there was I was growing up. I remember even in the 60s, we were talking about it, especially with the protest movements and all that. But here was a hero for young Americans because he stood up to Hitler from that popularized aspect of it. So in many ways, I think we wind up having two different figures there, the one we celebrate and maybe the one who was really there.
The theologian versus the public face.
But I think a lot of the church state things in Europe are not too different from a lot of American Protestantism today, where a lot of people just question somewhat from secularity, but they question the institutionalized church.
Yeah.
Because they don't see it working well in their minds out of their experiences. So I think that's a huge crossover.
Yeah,
both
I think
cultures.
Our system is not the best system.
Yeah, no, I But we've almost gotten there without becoming that system.
So when he's reflecting on these generations, what is kind of his? So he's looking at that both like culturally, so based on what they were all going through, and then how that impacted the way they interacted with the church, or.
Well, so I think. Part of the reason I left it there, because he gets a little bit more into like the politics and what it means to be a leader according to the younger generation, because they saw, and this is kind of where his theology goes, is they saw like the blunt force of the masses. Like if you have your commander and you're part of the army, then you listen to your commander, and then all of a sudden the individual doesn't matter as much because you just kind of obey orders. And so that's where it's the younger generation wanted that kind of leader, where it seemed like it was kind of that social philosophy that was internalized, that it was kind of like, this is how we grew up and are informed in this way, and that's how things were before the war and during the war, and so it's got to be the way that's after the war. And also, to some degree, this is debatable, that a lot of the Germans, many Germans, hated the Treaty of Versailles because it put all of the blame on them, and also the reparations were like insurmountable. And then all of a sudden they get into this next war. And so to some degree, they also wanted to go back to the monarchies of before democracy.
There's a lot of bitterness. And it's our right to get even, and they glory in the fact that Hitler looked like he was making me proud to be a German again. And it was very deep. And the thing that's scary is it goes back to Franco-Prussian War in the previous century, where so there's generations here of anger.
But is he commenting on, like, so what is he proposing a way, or he's just kind of recognizing these?
So this is 33 before everything's like, it's as things are happening,
starting.
So Bonhoeffer is not necessarily meaning this as a dialogue against Hitler himself, but more like the system of if you lose your individuality, then you also lose community. And that's where he's getting in, and we'll get into that in just a second. But if you subsume yourself to the collective, then you do whatever the collective says and you don't matter. And so he's pushing back on having this one monolithic leader. And a lot of his writings are. If that's going to be the case, if that's going to be the leader, then the leader actually kind of has to subsume himself under like the community. And there's a lot of responsibility, and the leader matters much less than the community does. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was doing a bunch of reading of the stuff that I printed out, and was remembering that it's very dense, and I had to read it about 3 or 4 times before I understood it. So I'm just going to read what I wrote at the end of last fall as kind of a summary of his doctoral dissertation, Sanctorum Communio, on the Communion of Saints. And if anything's unclear, please stop me, and I'll try not to be monotone.
It's tough for North Dakota to
do. Yeah, I know.
You bring in the helium.
All right. So his doctoral dissertation was written largely as a critique of differing schools of social philosophy. So social philosophy is kind of is the attempt to understand and to chart the basic categories with which to think about the social aspects of human life. And so this is what he's getting at in his radio address, is he's seeing this social philosophy play out, where you get this generation saying, the individuality doesn't matter. And this is how he pegs it. Certainly you get out the school of thought and don't agree with them. But this is what how Bonner sees it as his theology is pointing out. And he largely critiques Aristotle and Descartes, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, because he didn't think they could accurately inform a Christian social philosophy. Bonhoeffer's social philosophy, which is essentially, he's taking a little bit away from, you've got Kant and Hume and Heidegger and Kierkegaard and all of these philosophers who say, we're asking basically, among other questions, what it means to be human. And a lot of that is an epistemological question. And epistemology is, how do we know what we know? And so Aristotle and Descartes have different philosophies. And you've probably heard Descartes' cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And that's kind of his social philosophy. What it means to be human is to cognate, and not necessarily just think, but also be conscious. And Bonhoeffer says, he gets into that. So one of my professors, Clifford Green, says that Bonhoeffer's social philosophy was meant to speak to theological as well as anthropological topics. And so Bonhoeffer's taking it out of just the mind and more kind of embodying what it means to be a Christian into community and anthropological topics instead of just armchair philosophy, which is what he thought that Aristotle and Descartes were doing. Mm. So the social philosopher Aristotle says that, according to Bonhoeffer, the collectivity, as closer to the species, is set over the individual person. The human being is a political animal, and the state is the highest form of collectivity, which, by its nature, is prior to all individuality. So, pretty dense sentence. Aristotle's Greek, coming from the state where you subsume yourself to the state, and the state is the most important thing, and humans are supposed to be politically involved in the state, but the individual doesn't matter. But that's not what Bonhoeffer likes. Certainly, Aristotle has a lot of other good things about what morality means, and really pushes Bonhoeffer in other ways, but the social philosophy of what it means to be an individual is something that Bonhoeffer doesn't agree with. So according to Bonhoeffer's critique, the essential person for Aristotle lies outside of the empirical body, or in other words, the essential being lies beyond the individual person being. And so you lose your individuality because you're kind of shedding responsibility onto something larger than yourself. That kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. And Bonhoeffer did not see the use of pushing God outside of the empirical, to saying that to just shirk all of your responsibility. Mm-hmm. Let's see if I have it. In his footnotes, he said that the premise of the study of the Christian concept of person and social basic relations is that neither is abstracted from empirical social norms. And so this is, again, him trying to internalize theology into the individual and then talk about it in community rather than, and instead of losing all your individuality. On the other hand, Bonhoeffer was not convinced of Descartes' social philosophy either. Bonhoeffer commends Descartes for changing the concept of person from a metaphysical question to an epistemological question. Instead of something that is completely beyond yourself, Descartes puts it into something that you can actually talk about. And there are a lot of questions about what it means to know that are more kind of mind questions rather than metaphysical questions. And for Descartes, the metaphysical schema fundamentally denies the person by subsuming the person under the individual. Because again, it seems like Descartes takes away the individuality to the collective. So in turn, Bonhoeffer posits the sanctorum communio as a social philosophy that takes all of that epistemological questions of what it means to be a Christian and in turn presents a social philosophy that speaks to the Christian community. And there are a couple different, it starts, he has five different chapters. One's an introduction. And then primal state and the problem of community, sin and broken community, and sanctorum communio. So he gets a little bit about the problems and then presents something that works. And so I'm going to just talk a little bit about those different chapters and hope it's not too dense. And if we want to stop and have a conversation, we will. So to fully understand the Christian concept of person for Bonhoeffer, it means to be cognizant of the fall. So sin is a large part of what community means, because if community worked really well, or if we weren't sinful creatures, then community would work perfectly. The thing is, we always have to be evaluating what community means and living in community.
In a sense, the fall makes living in community challenging.
Challenging, exactly.
Which is gospel.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat.
And so before the fall, Bonhoeffer calls it the primal state. But it's interesting, he notes that we can't actually talk about the primal state because we're sinful creatures and we can't actually talk about creation perfectly. And so we still have to deal with the challenge of living in community. But he says that the primal state is hope projected backward. And so there was a time when everything was living in right relation, so there's, because of redemption, there will be another time where community is living in right relation. He also says, the doctrine of the primal state is necessary because it reaffirms original sin and necessitates the fact that the concepts of person and community are understood only within an intrinsically broken history. And so nothing's been perfect ever since the fall.
I don't know that theology, but in any way that's very creedal, because the three articles are there. You know, acknowledges creation and sin and the need for resurrection, and then what it means to live in that kingdom. So I don't know enough about it to take it farther than that, but it strikes me that way.
Yeah.
But that's kind of neat. Maybe that's part of his popularity in a lot of Christian circles, is that he, that to that simple creedal kind of theology.
So he starts off with the problem of community is that we're sinful creatures and living in community is difficult. So he then presents what he means by community, and a large part of it is he talks about will. And so this is kind of like, and this is in my article in Holden Village Voice, it talks about will is like self-conscious, or like the will to act, or the will to be. It's kind of like the will to do something is what Bonhoeffer's talking about here. Will is kind of like, is predicated on self-consciousness, that like you're a self-conscious creature and you know that you're willing to do something. And community for Bonhoeffer is when an individual, it as a willful, self-conscious creature, realizes that there's this barrier between like me and Margie. Like you are also a self-conscious person. So then I become, this is where it gets a little sticky, but I become an I when I realize that there's a you that I can't know as an I. Okay. And so there's like, I have this self-conscious will, and I realize that I have a self-conscious will, you have a self-conscious will that's different than mine. And so all of a sudden, we're defined by our relations, like our responsibility to one another. And he says, since I know myself as an I lift myself as an individual above the vegetated condition of the spirit in the community. And so that's, once I realize that I'm an I living in this community and I'm not subsumed by my general telling me what to do or the fear telling me what to do, I'm living in community. At the same time, however, in this very act, the essence of the you jumps up to meet me as the other spirit is that is conscious of itself. So when I'm living in community, I've got this I and you've got this you. You're defined by...
It would speak a lot to power within that because I can suggest what I think is good. Mm-hmm. But it means I also have to listen to what you think is good.
Yeah.
And those things sometimes really conflict, and then how you resolve that becomes part of that. And that's very modern for institutions today. Mm-hmm. Trying to figure that out. Is it, you have the dictator or you have a little sharing. Right now we're worried about the democratic process because enough people might vote for really a guy we're not sure we like for president. Mm-hmm. But that's the majority, and so the majority rules, and so all those questions come into that institution at that point.
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit of maybe that mentality of my vote doesn't matter.
That's another response. That's one of the three you said that the Germans were responding is stay out of it. Mm-hmm. Withdraw. Don't vote.
Because you're under the collective, that you're under this democratic system that you can't be an individual within.
Right.
And certainly it's, this is where Bonhoeffer says that it takes a little bit further. It says that, so I've got this I and you've got this you, and you've got a bunch of I's and a bunch of you's in this room, and we're all have this kind of like, we're doing the same thing, and so we're actually have like a representative will, if you will. Right now we're learning about Bonhoeffer. And so that's kind of like, all of a sudden this becomes one community living in relation. And it becomes almost like an I within itself. And so then, like Rio Tinto is an I within itself.
It's the corporate I.
Well, so even though, like, literally, though, the people down the street are their own group, and so then this is where you can have kind of like, and the mentality of my vote doesn't matter. These are the communities that come together, and they. This is where Bonhoeffer gets really interesting. Is that he says that as soon as you realize that there's an I and a you, and responsibility arises because you're a person, I'm a person. There's an ethical responsibility. And that's what it means to be a Christian person, is to recognize this ethical responsibility constantly as an individual within a community, and then also as a community in conversation with another community.
Mm-hmm. It gets interesting with subjectivity. Can we ever, I'm not sure if Bonhoeffer say we can get the objectivity.
Yeah.
It's always the closest we can get is being tolerant with our subjectivity or something like that, where we learn to live together. But we still whine about the decision somebody else made because we don't think it fits our eye.
So Bonhoeffer says that I come into being only in relation to the you, only in response to a demand does responsibility arise. And so this is kind of maybe the reason I like Bonhoeffer, is that it's not always has to be like a nice demand. It doesn't have to be a nice will. This is kind of like you can be yelling at each other and realize that there's an ethical responsibility between the two of you. But you're still individuals working together.
So he saw Hitler's regime as a bunch of youths who didn't have a sense of I, and would perhaps see our American culture as a bunch of I's without a sense of you.
I think what he was contradicting in his mentality was that Hitler was saying, like, nobody's an I, nobody's a you. There's no individual. Because you have to listen to whatever I say.
Because it states the I.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you define what the state is.
There's a we.
Yeah.
Only we.
Yeah, something like that. There's only a we.
But somebody's telling us what we are. We're not contributing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is also an extremely theological claim that because of that, a demand is made and responsibility to meet that demand arises. Bonhoeffer always says that only through God's active working does the other become a you to me from whom my eye arises. So all that recognition is because of God. And in other words, every human you is an image of the divine you. So it is because of this active working of God that I become an I, you become a you. There's a responsibility, and all of that is God's agency and the Holy Spirit working through. It's a little complex.
That may really get at this notion of love that we wrestle with today, what it means. Because when we love somebody, we accept their you as being okay.
He does get, actually, love is one of the next parts. So, I don't, maybe this is like one of the things I don't also perfectly understand, because there are some things about Bonhoeffer that I think make sense to me, but I'm confused, and he never quite really gets at why it has to be God's stuff. Or like, he talks a little bit about, in a little bit, all of these communities that come together are communities where Christ is present. And so it's he calls it church, but Gemeinde in German is either congregation or church. And it's just kind of, I think it's predicated on the where two or three are gathered, there I am as well, that when you have these a bunch of self-conscious eyes living in community, Christ is there too. At the center of kind of like the power that brings everybody together, and I think that's kind of what Bonhoeffer's getting at with the recognition of a divine you, is because Christ is at the center of community.
Well, when all those eyes are trying to figure out what the truth is, and Scripture is a model, but how's my faith related to what the truth?
I think that's, yeah, one of the implications of living in community with Christ at the center. Bonhoeffer is also a firm proponent of this whole thing is switching from a question of the, like the Trinity, of like how does that work, to who is that today? So he often asks throughout the rest of his life, who is Christ for us today? And a lot of it is his last letters that of being confused, he would ask, who is Christ for us today? Instead of how, like how metaphysically and epistemologically Christ works in all of this, it's just kind of a self-evident Christ is at the center of community. He's still working today. Christ is like serving an agent and doing God's work today. He's a student of Karl Barth, who is talks a lot about the ineffability of God, that you can't talk about God because God is God. He's wholly other. This qualitative terms that I have to know in seminary. Holy qualitative distinction, within a qualitative distinction, is something that you can't quite ever talk about because it's wholly other. But we can talk about God because of Jesus as God incarnate. And so Bonhoeffer says, even if we can't necessarily talk about God, we can talk about God through Jesus. And so when we ask him, who is Christ for us today? This is kind of like, how is God working in the world today? And Christ is the center of community, is working as a redemptive quality of God still today.
You know, when you look at all of us, we have had for centuries over trying to define or explain the Trinity to people, and we come up short all the time. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it becomes more of a distraction. We can talk about the creation and the fall and redemption and what it means now. But we try to attach human understanding to it. And mm-hmm. And so the people say, well, they never use Trinity in the Bible, so it's not. But those three factors are. Mm-hmm. And so it's an unanswerable question, but I think that's a powerful point.
Yeah.
To see what he's saying. That gets rid of having to worry about whether it's Father or Mother God, too, because we don't have to anthropomorphize
it. Yep.
can be our it God.
So one of the implications of living in community is that the person as another member of the community, of the church community, is no longer a claim but gift. He's a revelation of God's love and heart. Thus the you is to the I an object of love because of God's love living in community. That makes sense. Or just a bunch of like little points about what it means to live in community. So Clifford Green kind of sums it up in that for Bonhoeffer, the paradigm is not cogito ergo sum, like Descartes says, but rather, I relate ethically to others, ergo sum. So what it means to be a Christian person is to relate to others, to realize that there's a responsibility all the time, and then live in community. And it's not easy, but it's what it means to be a Christian person. I think we're going to stop there.
I plowed through page 18 to 35 in this Sanctorum Communio.
Yep.
And I thought that this is wonderful German intellectualism. I'm reflecting that community. Mm-hmm. But I also was stunned by the elegance of the words of Jesus. You know, where love God with all that we are, our mind, our soul, our body, our strength, and our neighbor as ourself. We're talking community, our neighbor as ourself. And some jackass lawyer asks, well, come on now, who is my neighbor? And then you get the Good Samaritan story. Mm-hmm. And the elegance of that against the wordiness of this seems to me to be an amazing contrast.
Yeah.
Where thy will be done or my will be done.
And I think, so this is his dissertation, and this kind of becomes prevalent in his other writings, and especially in discipleship, I think, is and life together, is kind of like what all of these mean when you live in community. Who's your neighbor, and you realize that you actually become a Christian person in relation to everybody.
Yeah, because if you see Christ in others,
yeah,
that's where you draw the line between which ones you see Christ in and which ones you don't. I mean, if you see that as part of your co-creation, that you're part of, and you love them, then you got to figure out how to live together.
Yeah.
And that's why these saints, like Mother Teresa, you know, seeing the face of Christ in this baby that would soon be dead.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Martin Luther King. The common good. I mean, it's not that complicated.
That is not to pull it out, but you know, we talked about his changing his voice in his last year of his life. Mm-hmm. That, in a way, that says to me, all of a sudden, you realize all this stuff I've been pondering about is real, and I've got to do it, and I've got to figure out how to love all these other people, even though they're going to kill me pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And that's the seriousness of faith and living your life.
But that's also the power of the Holy Spirit
right.
alive in you, where you die to yourself,
right.
and it is God. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Isn't St. Paul correct in that? I mean, it's not that complicated. Frankly, I prefer the words of Jesus and Paul in it. But, you know, it's certainly interesting to hear.
Well, the theologians have to.
That's exactly right.
They have to put all those words in there.
I think what he offers, at least in Life Together, which sounds like is just an interpretation, not a translation, but as somebody who reads the gospel looking for how to live Christ-like, it is difficult to hear Jesus say these short, succinct, powerful statements of how to be or what to be and not know how to be that. And I think Bonhoeffer says, here are some tools where you can really practice this.
And
I think, Bonhoeffer was a very important sermon on the mount, the bergfried.
Yeah, that's discipleship.
Yeah, that is his thinking and his and apostle.
Which is, if you pull something out of scripture, which you don't necessarily want to do, it covers all the basic points. If that's all you had left, that's not a bad piece to keep your hand on.
He does. He does a few other exegesis writings about it. So Creation and Fall, which is his third book, is it's like 187 pages written about Genesis 1-3. Yeah, he goes to town.
But there's German intellectualism. That's who he was. That was his family. That was his background.
It's great stuff, though. It talks a lot about sin and broken community, because that's what we hear about it in Genesis 1-3. Talks a lot about Adam and Eve and what it means to live in community early on. And it's all kind of predicated on the fact that Bonhoeffer writes that God created us in relation to God. So we were created as relational creatures. And so we're identified as within a relation to another. And so that's like, Descartes does not say that. He says, I think therefore I am. I'm an individual because I can think, or cognate, and all of his other simplistic, because that's Descartes writes a lot more than that. But Bonhoeffer says, I'm an individual when I realize that I'm set over and against another individual.
Well, yeah, Descartes, some people call him the father of humanism, or the fact that the person, I'm the center of it.
Yeah.
And from what I recall, Descartes never wanted to quite give up on his Catholicism, but he's at the same time pushing out the individual as the heart of the question. So
I think that's kind of getting at the part of how difficult it is to. It's unfortunate that Descartes is known largely for I think therefore I am, because he writes so much more and wrestles with, that's his social philosophy that seems to play out in his life, because it seems to ring true for him.
And what I remember after he struggled through some of his stuff, he wasn't a real happy guy. He struggled.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. That's not my field.
So for Bonhoeffer, his starting point is his community of theology.
Would you say then that in many ways Bonhoeffer was a pretty conservative theologian in today's terminology as far as the centrality of the major scriptural themes we've talked about?
Absolutely. Actually, he's a lot more conservative than people think.
So his radicalism didn't make him theologically radical?
No, I also think that this
kind
of, the current narrative of the Bonhoeffer scholars is actually kind of trying to rein in the radicalism.
Yeah.
Because
he was rebellious to the state, that's gotten a lot of attention.
Yeah, that's gotten a lot of attention.
So we can't all be protesters.
But don't you think, again, it's significant, because what hits me is, okay, that's how Bonhoeffer acted and lived and wrote during his time. But what about our time? If we're to be little Christ or we're to be little Bonhoeffers, you know, like the environmental thing. Or the economic thing. You just support the state, whatever the corporations want, that's great. Or keep your head down, maybe the storm will blow over. Or, like Bonhoeffer, we're going to act together in concert against this dominant thing. That means much more to me than just, you know, like a worm crawling through the dirt that he left us.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? I mean, otherwise it's like,
I think that's the community that he's talking about. Is
right.
Because it's...
That's what makes it relevant today, it seems to me.
Yep.
What's in it for us? What is expected of us?
When you look at the church struggling today, it struggles most where it's got the least amount of community and its institutional roles or something else.
Well, the struggle occurs when my will be done is being challenged.
And
that's when it gets complicated, because we keep trying to figure out, how am I going to win in this? And
well,
by serving, and you win by
serving. Sounds like you guys
just
group discussion, and
yeah,
it sounds like a debate is ensuing between the two.
Well, no, that's the discussion. Well, what do you think? I mean,
yeah.
Bonhoeffer.
He just wants other voices.
Yeah, just space to facilitate the conversation.
Well, speak up.
Yeah.
Give me more questions about. I know it's dense. It's dense. It's hard to kind of try to explain. But for me, at least, I think that when you realize that you're someone in comparison to another person, it's not necessarily comparing yourself to another person, but you relate to everybody. And so it helps me a lot when I'm in New York City and I'm like sitting on the subway and realizing that like there's a bunch of individuals.
Jesus in every one of them.
Yeah, there's an individual in every person. And so it really helps to humanize everybody, because as we saw and can see, dehumanizing other people is when you subsume them to whatever you want. And not just other people, that's where I take it with, but the environmental movement. Well, tomorrow, there are a couple case studies that are in the library that I'd like to talk about. And I think that hopefully Bonhoeffer can help us inform a little bit about how we might view those population cases. It's about 20 pages, but it's geared to be really easy reading. It's about maybe a 7 or 8 page actual case where you read it and kind of put yourself into their footsteps or their shoes. And then it comes with a commentary afterwards that kind of gives you a little bit more context and facts about the actual problem. And so I'd really appreciate it if you want to come tomorrow, if you'd read that.
Where in the library?
It's on one of the tables. And there's readings from today, and then there's also readings. It's not on the schedule yet, but we will be meeting here tomorrow at 3. And then we'll be meeting here again on Thursday at 3. And so there's day 3 reading, which is the case, and then day 4 reading, which is a poem.
Do you have enough copies?
There are 2, so I'd like them to stay in the library. Mm-hmm.